This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Fantasy Throwdown Podcast, bringing you the latest updates from the world of sports, gambling, and pop culture. Because you can't have a show without hot takes or a Tiger King meme these days. Know what I'm saying? Now, with over 200 episodes and ready to get after it again, here's your host, Dwayne Callender.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Fantasy Throwdown Podcast. I know folks have been asking me what the big plan is for episode 300, and to be honest, I really didn't put too much stock into it, really. I just wanted to keep it business as usual, but I can't think of a better story about the show in general than what happened yesterday in the UFC 267 pay-per-view, where you have a 42-year-old Glover Teixeira, basically at the end of his career. I mean, realistically, if he did not win yesterday in his title fight against Jan Blachowicz for the light heavyweight strap, he very well could have retired, because Glover had worked himself back into title contention over a span of, I didn't realize it was this long ago, but his title match against Jon Jones was over 7 years ago. I honestly could not believe it was that long ago that it was UFC 172 back in April 26, 2014 was his unanimous decision loss to Jon Jones. I couldn't believe it was that long ago. Honestly, it did not seem that long ago, but that's how crazy life is sometimes. Because we've seen Glover be just this dominant guy from originally being like Chuck Liddell's training partner, everyone waiting for him to try to come over to the United States from Brazil. And, you know, you see him progress to the point where he's a title contender. He loses to Jon Jones. He then loses his rebound fight against Phil Davis. I remember that fight. Like, Davis just basically smothered him with wrestling, didn't do anything, but technically he got the takedown, so he won the match. And then, you know, he builds himself back up. He gets a couple of wins, most notably over Rashad Evans, then gets just dropped by Anthony Rumble Johnson. I mean, that fight lasted less than 15 seconds. Because I remember the punch he landed on Glover that just destroyed him, because Glover was in line to try to get another title shot, and Rumble got it instead by just rocking Glover with that punch. And then you kind of say to yourself, man, I this might be, like, where does Glover go from here? Because it was Rumble got his rematch against Cormier at the time for the belt. But if Glover had won that match, he would have fought Cormier. Like, that was the eliminator fight. And then, you know, Glover basically becomes and that match with Rumble, and like, this is how crazy this is. That match against Rumble was over 5 years ago. Like, honestly, it doesn't seem that long ago in sports, but realistically, yeah, you start, like, as I start piecing this all together, It's crazy. I hadn't even started a podcast yet when Glover was like a mainstay in the UFC. But, you know, from that point on, Glover eventually becomes kind of like an upper gatekeeper guy in a division. He lost to Gustafsson. He had a bad loss to Corey Anderson. And then, you know, after the Anderson loss, he just goes on this, it was a 5-fight winning streak, you know, just kind of being a gatekeeper. And realistically, Glover got this title shot because Jan Blachowicz won the belt. There was really no one exciting in the division that Dana wanted to match him up with. So that's why you got Blachowicz versus Israel Adesanya. And I told folks this. Adesanya is a middleweight. Blachowicz is a light heavyweight. People thought Izzy was going to win that fight just because of his striking alone. And Blachowicz is a very good striker. And Blachowicz got the win. And it was the first, like, this was like the first fight in like 10 fights where Blachowicz was the actual favorite. Like, Blachowicz had like not been the favorite in pretty much any of his fights. And he gets this matchup against Glover because, listen, we love Glover, but Glover is 42 years old. I mean, you don't want to say guy is past his prime, but realistically, Glover is past his prime. I mean, it's kind of crazy just going about it, but I did not see the win condition for Glover other than Blachowicz making a mistake, which he did. Because Glover smartly, and I'm going to get to the point, Glover smartly used his knowledge as a fighter to his advantage to pull off that win. Because realistically, Blachowicz just needed to maintain proper distance with Glover. Do not let Glover get his hands on him to try to drag him down to the mat. Because Glover is still an expert in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and that was his win condition. If he could get the fight to the mat and make life incredibly difficult for Blachowicz. And Jan basically gave him the perfect game script, because in round one, he opened himself early, Glover took him down, held him down, kind of wore on him, and then so he gave away round one, and then in round two, Jan, again, knowing that he already lost the round, started getting even more aggressive, and Glover, again, seized on the moment and got another opportunity to take him down. And, you know, Blachowicz got hit and rocked a bit, but Blachowicz still committed to trying to get the submission on Glover, which I couldn't believe he tried a Kimura attempt on Glover, of all people. And Glover made sure this time, when he got him on the ground, he could get him in the spot to finish him, and he flattened him out. But where I'm going with this story is, and I know we're a couple of minutes into the show, you know, Glover basically spelled it out this way. It was 20 years of work that led to that fight. Like, all the setbacks that he had, everything that has gone, did not work out in his favor. The guy kept working. Because realistically, you look at his fight resume, he has just been grinding. Like, in an era of fighting where, you know, guys take time off, years off, like, Glover basically has stayed active for his entire UFC career, which goes back to 2012. Like, we've been watching it for almost 10 years in the UFC. Well, almost 10 years in the UFC, just fight at least twice a year. You look at his fight resume, and you say to yourself, man, I don't remember it being that long, because he's always there. He's always there, and he's always working. And, you know, the one thing that Glover kind of said, and, kind of stuck with me, like, it's always hokey, but it's like, never let anyone tell you what you can and can't do. Because at the end of the day, what he was saying is, you know, someone will always try to tell you no, that you can't do it and drag you down. and don't listen to them. You can accomplish what you want to put your mind to if you're willing to put the work in. And so, you know, I couldn't think of a better intro to that for episode 300 than that. A guy who just kept working, and got the biggest achievement of his career. To me, that, I mean, it was beautiful. I lost, like, truth be told, I had locked in Blachowicz because I know Glover's chin is not the best, so I knew if Jan got hold of him at his price point for DFS purposes, I was on Blachowicz. I did not bet Blachowicz as the favorite. I did play him for DFS purposes because the price on Blachowicz was cheap enough on DraftKings that if you got the knockout with the roster construction, I was in line to win a couple grand easily. And I just thought the win condition for Glover was so slim that it just did not, the valuation just did not make sense from a DFS perspective. But man, I can't tell you how happy I am to lose money over a fight, because to me, Glover's one of those guys where you just see the work being put in, and the message is true. You know, if you told me 4+ years ago when I started doing this podcast that I would still be recording episodes now and heading into episode 300 and still going strong and still got a lot more left to say, because I see and hear idiotic takes all the time, which drives me crazy, but it also kind of gives me fuel to actually keep going and doing this for longer, because, you know, it just doesn't change. It doesn't change. Like, sports is wonderful. You learn so much about yourself and like what people deem to be things that can and should happen. And I'll be honest, I did not give Glover enough respect in terms of what he can and can't do fighting-wise. I probably should have given him a little bit more respect from a DFS perspective, thought process-wise. But, man, I am so happy to lose money over something like that, because to me, it's a beautiful story. It really is. You know, a guy worked his ass off, and, you know, after many, many years in trials and tribulations, got to the finish line. And yeah, he's going to fight for another, he's going to make another fight, and he's going to do a title defense, and maybe he does not win against Jiří, and I'm going to butcher his last name, Prochazka. I always butcher it, but it doesn't matter. Like, Glover got to he got the belt. He got the strap. All that work, he got there. And to me, that's what, sometimes it's not even, like, the destination, it's the journey. Like, no one can ever discount what Glover did to get there. Like, you can't question that man's run over the years and, like, the guys he fought over the years. In terms of what he did, he more than earned that strap. I don't care what anyone says. That to me, that one was beautiful. So, without much further ado, we're gonna get into the NFL slate today. I have some thoughts on the World Series as well, but I'll be short and sweet with my World Series thoughts thus far. I am happy to see the Astros struggling as much as they are, because I am getting sick and tired of folks, and I talked about this before. Everyone keeps saying that the Astros are validated getting back to the World Series, and I keep asking folks, what do you mean they're validated? They you know them to be cheaters. You don't know if they're cheating right now or not, or trying to cheat, because once you start cheating once, it's just easier for you to go back to doing the same bad habits. You may not get caught, but you're actively thinking and trying to do other stuff to gain an advantage. So I don't understand how you could say you're validated when you don't admit to any wrongdoing whatsoever. It is utterly bizarre to me how anyone could view the Astros as a redemption story, given the fact that they have shown no iota of remorse whatsoever, and none of those players ever got punished. The manager got fired, but the manager seemed to be the only guy who tried to do something to stop them, but realized it was futile, and then kind of shrugged his shoulders and gave up. So AJ Hinch lost his job, but nobody else did outside of the GM, who was complicit in it as well. It's actually bizarre how the media kind of twists stories around. And then the other media story is everyone now complaining about the Atlanta Braves chop, which, again, has always been offensive. I feel as though folks just want to grasp at straws at this point, because we know the Atlanta Braves chop is offensive. What's more offensive is the Braves moving their stadium to the suburbs and making sure that the access to the stadium is so wholly inaffordable to some of the less affluent areas of Atlanta, shall we say, to make sure that the ballpark is mostly filled with with white people. But let's just call it what it is, because anyone who's done any sort of research on Atlanta knows that transportation system and where they put that stadium in Gwinnett County was in fact intended, and they've even said this publicly, to have less minority representation at that stadium. It's actually been documented. So to me, that's even more of a story than the chop at this point. The chop's easy to call out. It's a lot harder to do the in-depth analysis of how the Braves were able to move their stadium, having publicly noted on record that they didn't want people traveling to their stadium that weren't local to the suburbs of Atlanta, which is less diverse than other parts of Atlanta, while still maintaining that, like, they love Hank Aaron. I just love the hypocrisy. But hey, it is what it is. But we'll get into where I think the rest of the series is going to go, because Atlanta went up 3-1 in the series with another game tonight, which could be the series clincher, but I'll try to hit that later on today with my slate breakdown for DFS, just because I haven't been able to do a ton of content during the week while baseball has been on. But without much further ado, let's get into football. And, a lot of teams are off today for the main slate. You don't have a lot of high-powered offenses, so today is going to be a very interesting slate to kind of pick apart. But we're gonna be able to find some avenues of approach here, in my opinion, because I still think there's avenues of being successful here. It's just we got to be a little bit more deliberate in terms of how we're putting together our squads. But all in all, I still like where I've been able to get to in terms of my construction thus far for the week. But first up, we got two teams that are in very interesting crossroads right now between Carolina and Atlanta. Atlanta, 2.5-point favorites at home. Again, very curious line, because usually you're at home, you should just get the 3. Someone thinks Carolina can win this game. I'm very curious about this one, because to me, Carolina's been in a tailspin. Sam Darnold is basically on his last legs, because even if he wins this game, because of how badly he lost that game to the Giants, and believe me, Sam Darnold cost his team that game against the Giants last week. Don't make any mistakes about it. The Giants played hard, but realistically, that was a loss on Sam Darnold, because Darnold, he was on a struggle bus. He was absolutely on the struggle bus trying to maneuver that offense, and I don't know if you can come back from that at this point. I think Carolina is very much, if Miami can't pull the trigger on the Deshaun Watson trade, you're going to see Deshaun Watson, because the trade deadline is Tuesday, you're going to see Deshaun Watson in a Carolina Panthers uniform next week if Miami doesn't pull the trigger at this point. But, you know, Carolina, it's the same story. You don't have Christian McCaffrey. Sam Darnold's struggling throwing the ball. The pass protection has been great, but Sam Darnold is still struggling on locating receivers, which doesn't make any sense because he should have a rapport with Robbie Anderson. DJ Moore still doing his thing. This is just Darnold. I'm sorry. And I was trying to be as optimistic on Darnold, because I really liked the situation he was coming into, but he's just struggling reading the field, because I watched that game. I mean, you know me as a Giants fan, I still have to watch the team play. Like, the Giants didn't do anything fancy. Darnold was just not very quick at making the proper reads to execute the offense. It's just that simple. So when it comes right down to it, he's their biggest liability, because if he's not seeing the read, he's not getting the ball out quickly enough and letting those receivers do their work in space. And I don't know how you can fix that right now. I don't think it's fixable right now with the situation being what it is. So I as much as I'm remiss to actually give give an edge to Matt Ryan of all people, this very much comes across as a Falcons team that should win the game. Now, with that being said, the Falcons butcher games all the time, like without fail. So to me, this is like kind of one of those stay away bet spots, because yeah, Atlanta should win this game, but we know Atlanta to shoot themselves in the foot repeatedly. And on the flip side, you know, when it comes to Atlanta, if we're talking just from an X's and O's standpoint, Matt Ryan is dust. He's completely dust. So I really don't like any of the pieces of this game, to be perfectly blunt. And there's like talk that Calvin Ridley wants to get traded, and I don't know. Something about this game just tells me to stay away, but that price on Russell Gage keeps pulling me in at 4,200 on DraftKings. I don't know. I'm just not enamored with this game, but there's just too much wrong with both of these teams to actually feel good about any of it. But I would just take Atlanta and just kind of move on from there. Moving on, we got the Bengals traveling to the Meadowlands to play the Jets. Cincy's 9.5-point favorites. Man, the Jets are bad, but they play hard. I just don't see how the Jets actually cover this game. I really struggle to see Cincy not winning this one by 10. We're going to come to some other games where I could see maybe you can make an argument that the line's too big. But for the Jets, I mean, you got a backup QB in Mike White. I don't like the weapons. I don't think they really mesh well. I don't see anything here other than playing Joe Mixon on the Bengals side and move on. Jamar Chase got priced all the way up to 7,500. I just don't like the pricing on the Bengals this week. Everyone seems a tad too high. And if the Jets were a defense that rolled over, yeah, I could make a case for it. But I feel like it's trying to chase the performance of the prior week with playing Burrow and Jamar Chase. I'm not going to say you can't do it. I'm just saying, it just seems more limited upside because the Jets are going to prepare themselves to stop that attack. They're not a pushover type of defense. So I just don't think the Jets can score enough points. That's why I don't think the Jets can be safely covering this. If this was like 10.5, yeah, I could make a case for the Jets. When it's 9.5 and the Bengals can win this by 10, I think that's a fair line. I think this is like had like a 31-20 kind of game. And that's like being generous to the Jets, like somehow getting a turnover and scoring a touchdown. I don't see the Jets getting the 20 points. I could see the Jets defense holding Cincy to under 30, but I can't see the Jets getting to 20 points. And that's the problem. It's just, there's not enough points here. And again, I don't like this from a DFS perspective. You're going to hear this a lot because there's not enough points in this game. I'm sorry. There's just not. Moving on. You can play Joe Mixon at 6,900. I don't hate it. I'm not enamored with it either. I just don't see a lot of raw points coming out of this slate. So this is going to be one of those weeks where we're scrounging to find something that we're going to fall in love with, which I haven't yet. Even up to now, I still haven't yet. So we're going to keep moving forward. We've got the Rams playing the Texans. Rams are 14.5 point favorites on the road. I mean, here's the deal. Davis Mills should not be an NFL starting QB at all. For some reason, we've got him. For reasons that it's like the Texans are trying to take this entire season while not trading Deshaun Watson yet. They keep trying to squeeze every single drop out of this. They're going to have to trade him before Tuesday. But just a bizarre situation. The Rams, you know, they're going to win this game. I mean, this is a very safe survivor pick. I don't see anything that the Texans are bringing to the table that are going to trouble the Rams. It's just a matter of, you know, is there anything else we can do from a fantasy perspective? I want to play Darrell Henderson. You know, price tag on DraftKings and FanDuel are very reasonable. Cooper Kupp got priced all the way up now. He's 9K on DraftKings. You know, he's going to be expensive regardless of whichever site you're on. Now it comes to the point where, you know, you can't say that. You can't say that, it's a bad play to play Cooper Kupp at this point in fantasy year. The problem is that there's just too much going on. The route trees for the Rams are very limited. It's Cooper Kupp, it's Robert Woods, it's Van Jefferson, it's Tyler Higbee, and then it's Darrell Henderson out of the backfield. That's it. No one else is really playing offensively for these lineups. So it's just it's one of those things where, you know, because it's so concentrated, it's hard to fade the Rams because you know who's playing. So someone's going to get the work in this matchup. I'm just going to pick Henderson and Higbee and maybe have one Cooper Kupp lineup and hope that Robert Woods doesn't burn me. But, you know, can I honestly say that any of them are a bad play this week? No, because they're going to score points against Houston. I just don't know where it's coming from, but they're going to be able to put up points against the Texans defense. So, I mean, this is a terrible week of games. Just to be perfectly honest. Let's keep moving. Buffalo hosting Miami. Here's the thing. It's going to be windy in Buffalo. It's not going to be raining. I don't know what Dolphins team is going to show up. I don't think this Dolphins team is as bad as their record is. I don't think they're as good as they were last year. If Miami's defense shows up, Buffalo is going to have a tough time covering the 13.5-point spread. So you can bet the Dolphins as on the spread. I think, obviously, Buffalo wins, but it depends on what Dolphins team shows up. Like, the Dolphins have been so unmotivated this year. I don't know what the issue is going on down there, but realistically, I think they can actually do well here to keep the game close. And by well, I mean keep the game close. I don't think they're going to win. I'll get to the game. I actually do think you could have an upset, but I don't know what to make of this Dolphins team, because Tua just, you know, if Devontae Parker was healthy, maybe things might be better. You got Gesicki. Like, I just don't see this offense moving with Tua under center, and it's becoming troubling, to say the least, that, you know, he's getting healthier, yet still they can't move the ball. I don't know what else to make of it other than Tua just doesn't have it. And it's just as simple as that. Realistically, we should have seen more by now. So the Dolphins could just be a mediocre team still needing to search for another quarterback. They should be in on the Deshaun Watson sweepstakes. We are pretty sure they are. It looks like publicly they're trying to hem and haw to drive down the prices of Deshaun Watson. Honestly, I think they just wasted time. You know, folks may say that the Dolphins are multiple pieces away. I don't think they're that far off. I just think they don't have a motor. Like, they don't have a motivation for those guys to play hard, because I think most of the people in that locker room look at Tua and see that, man, we traded Fitzpatrick for this guy, and you're seeing the after effects of it. I think that's the biggest issue with Miami right now. I just don't think that team actually believes in Tua Tagovailoa. So until that situation changes, or Tua either plays better or they trade for Watson, I think this Dolphins team is just going to meander. On the Bills side, obviously you can play Stephon Diggs. Josh Allen's the most expensive QB on the slate at $8,100. The price tag just seems a bit too rich for that amount. But again, there's not a whole lot of value on this slate to begin with, so I'm not going to be opposed to saying play Josh Allen and Stephon Diggs together. It's just, again, one of those slates where it's like, I could see this backfiring or it could work out well. It's a lot of variance, and there's not a whole lot of matchups that, you know, can say, man, this is where you need to go with the slate. I just look at this and say, I think the Dolphins put up a fight here. I just don't know if that offense could score enough once the Bills get going. I just don't know. I really struggle figuring out what this Dolphins offense is, because the running game ain't there, and it looks like Tua needs a lot to help support him, and I just don't see him being able to drive that offense. It's just as simple as that. Next up, Jalen Hurts and the Eagles travel to Detroit to play the Lions. Eagles 3.5-point favorites. Here's the problem. Philly's defense isn't any good. Jared Goff blows chunks. Just blows chunks. I know people were waxing poetic about how well he played last week. That's a bunch of bull. The team played hard. Jared Goff took advantage of the Rams playing man-to-man, and his individual receivers won some matchups here and there, but Goff himself did not do very much in that game, to be perfectly blunt. The thing is, the Eagles should be giving him looks to exploit down the field. It's just that if Goff can't execute, Detroit's going to get stomped in this game, because Philly is going to be aggressive. Philly is going to be an aggressive defense no matter what. It's just your job as a QB to punish them. If Jared Goff cannot punish the Eagles are going to blow them out by probably 20 points. It's really that simple. I think if Goff can use TJ Hockenson and DeAndre Swift out of the backfield, because they're going to have good matchups in space to create, I think Detroit can string together multiple drives and put up points on the board. If Jared Goff cannot move the ball and can't make the reads quickly enough, Philly is going to stomp them. Because as much as I think Jalen Hurts is a terrible QB, he can still move around enough, and just that barely bit of being above average in enough attributes to offset the fact that he can't hit the broadside of a barn, you know, he has composure. He can move. He does not necessarily make the wrong decision. It's just the fact that he can't execute precision passes. But against Detroit, you don't need to be that precise against their defense. It's just a matter of, you know, can you put enough pressure on Philly if you stop their passing? Because Philly can't run the ball. It's all going to be predicated on, and well, actually, I shouldn't say that. I can't say Philly can't run the ball. Philly has not even attempted to run the ball with Miles Sanders. Now Miles Sanders is injured. We got Boston Scott in there. People are gravitating towards Gainwell. I would say if Philly actually tries to run the ball, it's going to be through Boston Scott, who's dirt cheap on DraftKings at 4,400. The problem is Philly has shown no inclination that they want to run the ball. So I have no idea what to make of the Philly offense other than Jalen Hurts just having to do it on its own. And doing it on his own, I think Philly basically scores 24 points. And it just comes down to, can Jared Goff move the ball? Like I said, I think Detroit can win this game, but it's all predicated on a Jared Goff not completely sucking. I think if he does an average job, they can win this game because Philly is going to give them chances to move the ball and score points because Philly's just going to be ultra aggressive. And there are ways to punish that. But if you have no way of punishing that, you are going to get stomped. This is one of those games where it's like, I don't want to bet this. But I would not be... I don't think it's the craziest thing in the world to say Detroit can win this game. Because they absolutely can because of the way Philly plays defensively. It's just that if you have an awful quarterback, Philly can punish you. If you have someone who's actually good like Dak Prescott, he's going to torch that defense. Jared Goff is awful. So, like I said, I think Philly wins this game, but it's not one where I would actually feel confident in them if I was playing Survivor Pool. I think that would be one of those danger picks because I think Detroit can actually win this game because Philly's defense isn't good. And Detroit, if Goff can actually play average, not good, just average, they can put up points, enough points on the board to actually beat Philly at home. So, I don't know. It is what it is. I think this is the game that if Jared Goff flames out in, you can bench him. Because this is the game he should be able to punish a defense, given the amount of time he's had in the league. Moving on. From a DFS perspective, I talked about this already, but TJ Hockenson and DeAndre Swift would be options I would go with. Hockenson's 5,500, Swift is 7,100. On the Philly side, I don't really like the Philly pieces because Jalen Hurts is priced up this week. Yeah, he can put up points. I just don't think he can put up enough points to make me feel warm and fuzzy about it. DeAndre Swift is basically the only piece I'm interested in at 6,500. But yeah, don't like this game at all, to be honest. I'm probably going to be light on it. Moving on. Pittsburgh, Cleveland. Oh, I want to turn the page on this game so quickly from a fantasy perspective. I have no interest outside of Nick Chubb at 6,800. Everyone else, they can F off as far as I'm concerned. There is just no point in playing anyone else in this game, in my opinion. None. You're just grasping at straws from a fantasy perspective. There's no reason to play anyone else. But Cleveland 3.5-point favorites. I would just bet Cleveland and move on. Steelers will play hard. They have no offense because against a good defense because Ben cannot throw the ball down the field. I will keep saying this. Big Ben cannot push the ball down the field. So against any defense that is halfway decent, which Cleveland does have a good defensive line, their secondary isn't that bad. I don't understand how anyone could actually reasonably say the Steelers have a good shot at winning this game. It is what it is. Like, Cleveland's a decidedly better team right now. That's all there is to it. Next up, Chicago hosting the 49ers. Chicago is 3.5-point underdogs. Here's the deal. If Jimmy Garoppolo can't get a win here against a Bears team that is flailing on offense, Jimmy Garoppolo might as well not board the team flight back home to San Francisco, and Trey Lance can just take over for the rest of the year. This, to me, is... Come on, Jimmy. It's like, I don't care if George Kittle isn't playing. There is no reason why the 49ers can't take care of business in this game. Cover that 3.5-point spread. Like, this should be a lock game. Justin Fields looks lost running this offense. Now, Matt Nagy is not going to be there because of COVID. It should not matter, in my opinion. I just think, point blank, that this Chicago offense is broken. The passing attack is non-existent. Allen Robinson is having a career worst year, and it's not his fault. It's just a quarterback in over his head in Fields. And then even with that, Andy Dalton was done. Like, there's no juice on that Chicago team right now. None. So, yes, I know Khalil Herbert has run the ball well. San Francisco's defensive line should be able to shut that down. And yes, I know the 49ers secondary is in tatters, but until Justin Fields shows me he can read coverage and throw, I'm just staying away from this game entirely. I have no interest in anyone in this matchup. Even Khalil Herbert. Yeah, I know people want to play Eli Mitchell. Hakeem Hicks is supposed to be back for the Bears. I'm not messing with this. I'm just moving on. I'm just saying, if the 49ers don't win this game, Jimmy Garoppolo might as well be benched. It just doesn't make any sense if you can't get a win in this matchup. Now, for the actual game that I want to talk about for the DFS slate, Tennessee traveling to Indy to play the Colts. I think that Carson Wentz should be the number one QB for fantasy this week. Followed closely behind by another QB I'm going to get to. But I think it's just clear as day. Carson Wentz is going to have a matchup that he can take advantage of with the Titans secondary and just targeting Michael Pittman. I think this is just too easy of a matchup. It, you know, folks may want to just get cute with it and just try to go to other spots, but the matchup basically dictates itself. Tennessee is going to run the ball with Derrick Henry. They're going to try to play action with A.J. Brown. There's no Julio Jones to take away target share from A.J. Brown. So you can take your choice of Henry or Brown, and then you run Carson Wentz with Pittman. And you can also add Mo Alie-Cox at the tight end spot because he's only 3,200. And just go from there. Like, why are we trying to make this slate harder than it has to be? Yes, could Ryan Tannehill get there as well? Yes, but if Derrick Henry smashes, then Tannehill's not going to get the touchdown. So I would say, instead of just risking that Tannehill's going to get the touchdown throws, just play Carson Wentz, and then you could play A.J. Brown and Derrick Henry along with Michael Pittman and Mo Alley Cox. Like, there are ways to get to find enough value on this slate that you don't need to actually play these other plays. I just think if you target this game and the line is at 51, this is a low total week for football purposes and for fantasy score. It's going to be low totals, like projected across the board. I just think that, you know, just target the game and just run with the guys you know who are going to get action. Yes, we could target the Rams game, but the problem with the Rams game is you don't know who's scoring the points. It could be five guys. With this Titans-Colts game, realistically, the point production is coming from about four dudes. Yes, you could get the random one-off catch, but by and large, the bulk of the damage done by each team has been coming from the four guys I mentioned. So, why not go there? I'm not worried about T.Y.A. Hilton possibly playing in this game because T.Y. has been more of a decoy this year. That's just a fact. So, I'm just not going to overthink it. I'm just going to go right ahead with that play. Now, on to the afternoon side of things. We got Washington traveling to Denver. Denver 3.5-point favorites. Again, I don't understand how are people saying that the Broncos are that much better than Washington? This should just be a 3-line. I'm taking the Washington side, and I'm just moving on. This game sounds terrible. Washington, while they're not good, we know Denver's not good either. I just don't really see where we're going to get a ton of points. Yeah, it will come down to can Denver punish Washington's weak secondary. But Denver likes running the ball so much that I don't even know if they're going to take advantage of Washington's weakness in the secondary. Washington wants Denver to try to run the ball. Vic Fangio is one of the worst coaches in the league. He may just want to insist that they run the ball, and I think that plays into what Washington wants to happen. So I'm going to take Washington here. I don't really feel great about the game in general, but I'm gonna just say that Washington gets a W on the road and just move on, because from a fantasy perspective, you could play Terry McLaurin, but he got priced up, so he's in the 7K range. You could play Cortland Sutton. He's at 6,400 on the Denver side. But outside of that, I don't have interest in this game. There's no reason to play this game. Next on the docket, we've got New England traveling to LA to play the Chargers. Chargers, 5.5-point favorites. I'm never going to say at this point not to play Justin Herbert with a receiver like Keenan Allen or Mike Williams, but I will always give benefit of the doubt to Belichick of coming up with some kind of game plan to slow things down. So, it's not that I'm against playing. I'm not against playing Herbert and a receiver. I don't think I'm going to get there on the main bill afternoon only. Yeah, we could definitely discuss playing Chargers. I don't think I'm going to get there on my main bill just because I think there's enough ways that New England can slow them down that the upside isn't nearly there. And I have another game in mind for the afternoon slate I would much rather target. So, to me, I'd be looking at Keenan Allen only, and hope that it's not Mike Williams. It's either Keenan Allen or Mike Williams. Mike Williams more expensive. Keenan Allen's 6,500. Mike Williams is like 7,700, I believe, on DraftKings. He's got a really high price tag on DraftKings. It's just that, all in all, It's a hard sell. It's a hard sell trying to get there with LA because you know Belichick's going to take away one of those guys unless he focuses on Eckler. And even that, I'm not as like enamored with Eckler in this matchup. Like New England's good tacklers. I don't know. To me, like something about that game just tells me this. Don't try to tempt it.
So I'm not going there, realistically, unless it's afternoon only. Next up, we've got Jacksonville traveling to Seattle to play the Seahawks. Seahawks 3.5-point favorites. Listen, the Seahawks have a very badly exposed weakness. It has not been punished enough in recent weeks, but they are just so vulnerable in the secondary to dump off passes. It was coming up again last week as well, even with all the rain going on and the Saints struggling to move the ball at times. They could still get it done just with short passes against the Seahawks. I think Jacksonville has a chance of winning this game because James Robinson, that is his game and bread and butter, is catching those short dump-off passes and making things happen. So I look at it and I say to myself, there's a chance that it could end up backfiring on the Seahawks here where, you know, now the season's starting to turn in a very bad direction, and they really need to find a way to get it done. And I don't know if they can at this point. I think the season may be too far gone, even with that defense and Urban Meyer making mistakes. I think Jacksonville has enough talent, and the few things that they're good at, are receivers catching the ball in space and making defenders miss, and running, Seattle is terrible at. So it's just like their greatest weakness is the one area where Jacksonville has actually shown to be pretty decent at. Jacksonville can win this game. So I actually like Jacksonville to cover, and I think they can actually win this game. So the line actually looks pretty good money line wise for Jacksonville. I'm tempted enough to actually take the Jags on the road, even though I know Urban Meyer's awful. It's actually enticing enough where I would actually contemplate taking the Jags just because, you know, folks are just banking on Seattle getting it done, and I don't necessarily see it. It's like they could just be, they are what they thought they were, just a bad team. And you know, Russell Wilson wanted out for a reason. He just saw the writing on the wall that this team's window had closed. You know, he got the money, but the problem is that, you know, I don't think Seattle's just good enough. And you know, Jags plus 164 on the money line, it's not the craziest thing in the world. I'm just saying. I would like a little bit of fatter line, but it's not the craziest thing in the world. So we move on. We've got the game that I want to talk about the most in the afternoon. Tampa versus the Saints. The Saints are 4.5-point dogs at home. And I'm going to be blunt. Everyone screws this up every year, and it happens twice a year. I don't understand it. Do not play Mike Evans against the Saints. Period. It doesn't matter if Marshawn Lattimore is in the lineup or not. Do not play Mike Evans against the Saints. Mike Evans has a personal beef with the Saints, specifically Marshawn Lattimore, but it doesn't matter because as long as Mike Evans is playing against the Saints, the Saints, as a rule, they would rather take a defensive penalty than give Mike Evans a touchdown. So if you look at Mike Evans and his stats against the Saints, they are so drastically different than any other opponent he plays. They are half of what they should be. And the thing of it is that he's only averaging about 50 yards a game against the Saints compared to everyone else. And he doesn't have nearly the amount of touchdowns. They go out of their way to make sure that Mike Evans cannot beat them. So, from my perspective, if we're being honest with ourselves, the way to go about this is, simply put, you take Chris Godwin and you take Leonard Fournette, and you just go with those two options. That's it.
Like, someone is going to benefit from all the penalty yardage Mike Evans is going to draw. So, instead of trying to figure out if it's going to be Gronk or, like, because Gronk is supposed to be coming back today. We don't know for sure yet, but it's likely that Gronk's playing. Instead of just trying to play the roulette of who Brady is going to target, we know Mike Evans ain't going to be the guy. But we do know that he's going to draw penalty yardage. So let Mike Evans not get anything done and fail. And you've been warned not to play Mike Evans for fantasy purposes. Do not play Mike Evans. Yeah, maybe he gets a touchdown somehow, but they are going to go out of their way to make sure he cannot score on them. So take the penalty yardage and just let the Brady go over to Uncle Lenny in Leonard Fournette or target Chris Godwin in the red zone or Gronk if Gronk's playing and have that be your recipe with playing Tampa. But don't play Mike Evans. On the flip side, when it comes to the Saints, we know Tampa secondary is terrible. You know Alvin Kamara catches the ball in space. Yes, we've got split wide receivers, but the receiving corps for the Saints has been playing better. Marquez Callaway has caught on. Traquan Smith got back last week. He looked shaky in spots, but they still had some connection with Jameis, and he loves throwing to Traquan Smith. I'm sorry, but it works out well enough that this Saints passing attack is going to do work against Tampa, because Tampa is going to be a run funnel where you can't run up the middle. You can run at the sides and up the field, but it's not going to be nearly the same as just throwing the ball into space and letting them run with it. It's just not the same. So instead of treating Kamara as a running back, look at him as basically, you got to look at him as a wide receiver. And he's 8,700, so he's one of the most expensive guys on the slate. But he is essentially a wide receiver that you know is going to get a lot of volume and looks when they kind of move out in space. So treat it as such. Treat it as not a running back, but a wide receiver who's just going to get 8 to 10 targets and go from there. Because it's pretty cut and dry that the way to beat Tampa is throwing the ball on them. And so you got Marquez Callaway, you got Traquan Smith, you got Kamara, and yeah, you could, if Deontay Harris is active today, you can play him too. But those guys are going to get a ton of targets. And Jameis is going to throw the ball 40 plus times today. I think Jameis is pretty much the only QB on the slate with a chance at a 400 yard game today. This is a low scoring slate overall from the projections. So to me, the way to attack this slate is to keep going at like the teams with the weakest secondary that are locks to have multiple passing attempts. Just keep chucking on them, because I don't see where it works out otherwise. I just think that that's the way you have to go about it. It's just, you know, seeing where the chips fall. But I think the obvious things, the most obvious thing here is Tampa with getting yardage through penalties and setting up red zone opportunities for Godwin and Uncle Lenny. And then on the New Orleans side, when they're playing catch up, they're going to be targeting and splitting out, but they're going to have a ton of receptions. I just think on DK, the play is Jameis with a couple of pass catchers, and then you run Godwin. Or you can run Fournette as well, depending on how you set up the running backs. But I think it's pretty clear the play here. So that does it for the main slate. We have Sunday Night Football with the Cowboys and Vikings. I don't know if I'm going to actually get into that slate for showdown purposes. I don't see pricing available yet, but to me, the question always comes down to, is Kirk Cousins going to show up in a primetime game? And I don't like playing that game. So to me, I'm just going to probably play lighter on that slate, because if Cousins doesn't show up, Dallas takes that game pretty easily, and you're left like holding the bag because you're playing, trying to play Thielen and Jefferson, and Cousins just doesn't measure up if he's having a bad day. I don't know what to expect out of Kirk Cousins more often than not. So I'd rather not play that game. So I'm not going to do it. I would rather just do my little piece of caveat emptor. Don't go too crazy. Try to play the showdown slate tonight, because this could easily be a Cowboys dominant game and the Vikings just don't show up. So, you know, I would be more or less playing Dak in the captain or Zeke in the captain and just work from there and not try to get too cute with it, because I've definitely seen this story before where folks just start talking themselves into Kirk Cousins, and we know what Kirk Cousins is when it comes to primetime games. It's not a good look. So not going there. We'll see how the slate works out, but I'm not going there. So it's as simple as that. So that leaves us with my Giants and the Chiefs. I really don't want to talk about the Giants, so I'm going to leave the episode on a good note and duck out. We can talk about the Giants tomorrow in what is likely to be a slaughter against the Giants, but you never know. So that's all for now, folks. Have a good one, and until next time, enjoy the games, and best of luck to everyone, and thanks again for listening to the show over the year. So thank you, and until next time, goodbye.
Thanks for listening to the Fantasy Throwdown Podcast. Be sure to like and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and all other major outlets.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.